You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been well over a year since the world learned that Flint was in the throes of an environmental disaster. In the early months of this year, the Flint water crisis brought a steady stream of political leaders promising aid and vowing it wouldn't happen again. President Obama, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, President-elect Trump. And here we are at year's end, and Flint hasn't seen a penny of that promised federal aid. And now there's a new curveball that could threaten the federal funding. Flint's Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee is here with us now. Congressman, we're talking about, what, a multi-billion dollar water projects bill. What was in the Water Resources Defense Act for Flint?
There was a provision that would provide $170 million for support for Flint. Part of that might be available to other communities, but at least $120 million would go to Flint. We've been fighting for this, you know, obviously since this water crisis began. We've hit a lot of roadblocks. It took a long time to get many of the members of Congress, and particularly the majority, to acknowledge that there's a federal responsibility to act. And now, you know, we have yet another one of these roadblocks. We've been able to overcome them in the past. I am confident in the next few days we will be able to do that again, and we will simply not give up until we get help for the people of Flint.
And describe this new roadblock, this new curveball.
Well, there's some additional language that's been included that relates to California drought issues, and it raises some questions about environmental policy. You know, there are always reasons to oppose legislation. This was something that was added at the very last minute, I think, because they know that there's a lot of will to pass this WERDA bill, and a lot of that will is based on the acknowledgement that we have to do something for Flint. So in some ways, there's an attempt on the part of Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader of the House, who's from California, to sort of use the momentum that we've created around Flint to get one of his priorities funded. The problem is there's not a lot of agreement around that issue, and it could make it more difficult for us to get the bill passed. And that's what we're facing right now.
And Senator Dianne Feinstein was the Senate, the
exactly.
One behind it.
Right.
And California Senator Barbara Boxer, I heard her, quote, calling it a last-minute poison pill. So could that kind of opposition tank the entire bill?
It could. We don't think it will. You know, obviously puts all of us in a tough position because there are no perfect bills that ever come to the floor of the House. Very often, we have to sort of weigh the positive and negative aspects of legislation, especially when we're not the ones writing it. I mean, the only provisions that we've written are the Flint provisions. And this will be another one of those cases. For me, and I know for Senator Stabenow and Senator Peters, both of whom have been just relentless to get this done, for us, you know, the priority is getting Flint funded. And we will, you know, be able to vote, I think, for this legislation, knowing that there might be some aspects of it that are not perfect, but there's no way in good conscience that Congress can adjourn without getting this legislation for Flint passed.
You know, as we're having this conversation, at the same time on the state level, federal judge David Lawson, I'm sure you're on top of this, has ordered the state to deliver bottled water door-to-door to homes in Flint that don't have properly installed filters. He rejected the state's appeal, saying, no, the state needs to bring the aid to the residents and not make them come to haul water home. And now the state's appealing his order to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, basically saying, don't make us do this. It's too complicated. It's too expensive. With all of this, what we're talking about with this new curveball from the federal side and what we're seeing on the state level, what does this say to you about government response to people in Flint who are in crisis?
Well, I think it says, you know, that there are communities that are often overlooked, that are a second thought. And in many ways, as I've said this before, the response of government to this crisis feels a lot like the conditions that caused the crisis in the first place. The state's willingness to put the health of Flint residents secondary to a sort of balance sheet, bottom line approach to governing is what caused this crisis in the first place. And now we see again, there's always an excuse not to come up with the dollars to make it right. There's always some reason. And it's hard for me to accept that if this crisis were occurring in some affluent, well-connected community, that there would be this sort of willingness to overlook Flint over and over again. Now, here's the thing. We are not going to give up, and we will succeed. We should not have to fight so hard for this, though. It should not be that Senator Stabenow, Senator Peters, and I have spent the entire year with this as our most serious and significant priority. It should have been done right away, right at the very beginning. It hasn't, and we're not going to give up until it does, but it says something about what has happened in this country when a community can be poisoned by its own government and not even have that government step up to make it right.
Flint Congressman Dan Kildee, as always, thanks so much, Congressman.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. The vote recount continues in Michigan, even as State Attorney General Bill Schuette and the campaign of President-elect Trump keep pushing forth with challenges to that recount. Recounting began Monday in Oakland and Ingham counties, and Wayne County began today. And a growing awareness is happening of technical problems coupled with possible human error, adding up to precincts that cannot be recounted. Chad Livengood of the Detroit News has been reporting on the recount issues, and he's with us now. Chad, what kind of problems are we seeing that are preventing precincts from being recounted?
Well, there's a lot of procedures you have to go through before you can actually recount a box of ballots, basically, from an individual precinct. And these procedures want to make sure that there's never been any tampering with these ballot boxes. They're usually in, like, almost suitcases, basically. And they've been locked up since Election Day. They got a zip tie seal on them. And with that seal, there's a number there that shows how many ballots are on that. And then from there, they have to, when the election workers have to look at that number and compare it to what's in the poll book, which is the book that the worker records when you get a ballot when you're at the polls. So they want to make sure that those numbers match up. And in the canvas of Wayne County in particular, they found that 36% of the precincts didn't have numbers that matched up. And there's a lot of reasons. Sometimes they have explanations. When they have an explanation, that can be recounted. But when there's not an explanation and they can't reconcile it by just manually counting the ballots to see if they add up, then that precinct gets set aside and is not recounted. Now, it still counts in the final tally of numbers, but it has to be the tally on election night, not on the recount.
What do we think is behind that, or what's the best guess? Is this exhausted precinct workers or nefarious doings?
Well, a lot of people are going to try to draw conclusions here. Now, the numbers that are off are almost always about one ballot off. The majority of them are one ballot off, and at the most, they're five ballots off. Now, five ballots in lots of precincts can make a lot of difference in things. But like in Wayne County in the suburbs, 72% of them were off by one ballot. And there can be reasons. Ballots get jammed in the machine. Someone wants a new ballot. They spoiled it, and it gets cast. And so there's different explanations that come along with this. But the election law is pretty well prescribes this procedure to go through to see if it's eligible to be recounted. And that includes if the number doesn't add up, they count it once. If it doesn't add up, then they count it a second time. And if it does add up on the second time, then they have to count it a third time.
It is kind of head-spinning, and I know I saw your piece in the news yesterday when the recount had not even begun in Wayne County, and you had the story that over half of Detroit and nearly one-third of Wayne County's vote was possibly ineligible for a recount. How was this clear before they even got started counting today at Cobo?
Yeah, we're working off the Wayne County canvassers report that details the discrepancies they found in the canvas of the vote, where they're looking at the poll book, they're looking at the tape that comes off the machine that kind of print out for precinct reports. But the canvassers never break open, or rarely ever break open, ballot boxes to try to see what's going on themselves. We don't have any kind of real mechanism for an audit in this state of election results, which is one of the larger issues that Jill Stein is trying to raise here. You don't necessarily have to recount 4.9 million ballots, but you could recount 150,000 random ballots and maybe get a sense about whether everything is kosher. So we just went on the report. Now they're going to use that report as a guide in that recount in Wayne County at Cobo Center to basically determine and use that to figure out whether precinct can be, in fact, recounted.
And what if stories of beat-up old voting machines that just couldn't cut it on election night?
Well, there's always that factor. And these voting machines are over a decade old. They were bought post-2000 election when all the reforms kind of swept the country, following all the problems with punch card ballots and hanging chads in Florida. So, yeah, we got into this optical scanning equipment, which is usually pretty good, although in recounts they do find that faintly marked ballots sometimes don't get scanned or counted, or you might have marked it outside of the oval or outside of the arrow, and that doesn't get counted. And so, you know, there's different things that arise in recounts when you start looking at these things by hand, and that's why the numbers start changing.
Now, you tweeted that you're hearing from readers pretty steamed up over precincts not being recounted, and they're concluding this is proof of voter fraud. Is it?
Not necessarily. I mean, it could be proof of human error, and it certainly could be proof of exhausted election worker trying to reconcile votes at 11 o'clock at night or midnight after a 14-hour day at the polls. That's what some of the proponents of this recount are trying to use it to try to, you know, have a good autopsy of just how exactly we account for balloting in this state.
Chad Livengood, Detroit News. As always, thanks, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, one educator believes charter schools might be hurting, not helping, African-American communities.
I think there's been a disproportionate amount of effort to apply charter schools to Black communities instead of allowing Black communities to reform themselves.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan boasts an exceptionally rich mix of folk, ethnic, and immigrant music, and it goes back centuries. University of Michigan music professor Lester Montz wanted to capture that rich tapestry, so he spearheaded the Michigan Musical Heritage Project, and what a story it tells. Lester, so good to have you with us here on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
Now, this project seemed to have three distinct goals. What are they?
One is to complete a full documentary on Michigan music. We hope to have that broadcast on some public television station. We hope to have cooperation from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and so forth. The second goal is to create an archive, a video archive of Michigan's music. We have a number of archives with audio examples, but not much with video. So that's the second goal. And then the final goal is for me to teach a course here at the university on Michigan music. I scoured through all of the catalogs of the public institutions in the state. I did not see one course that's fully dedicated and devoted to Michigan music, and I hope to be the first.
When we say Michigan music, what ethnic and immigrant traditions really jump out at you when we talk about Michigan music?
Not one really jumps out. Yeah. We're such a musical mosaic in this state that so many different immigrant groups, ethnic groups, folk groups have moved into the state, mm-hmm. and many of them have maintained or compartmentalized much of their music and culture, but others have sort of fused together in such a way that they have created something very new.
So give me an idea of some of these traditions that either who are the more standalone ones versus who've done more morphing and evolving?
Well, look to the Irish Folk Music Festival in Muskegon. You do have a combination of both the things we were talking about. First, you have music that has benefited from jazz, from folk music, from other European immigrant groups. First of all, you have the fusion of the Scottish and the Irish together. And then on the other hand, you have this bluegrass music that takes shape in terms of its improvisation from jazz and other kinds of popular music. And so, you have in this one setting this real eclectic performances of music, which is really exciting.
And so you kind of spent the summer last year crisscrossing around the state going
last
to different
summer,
festivals, right?
The summer of 14 and the summer of 15 and 16. We have been scouting all of this out, and we have one more summer to go. There's so much happening in Michigan music, you can't cover it all in one summer. And because we have to travel far distances to the Upper Peninsula, way out west, sometimes it takes us a whole weekend just to cover one festival.
And what are some of the other festivals that you've been able to record and grab?
We've been to festivals in Hart, Michigan, the Hispanic Celebration there. We've been to the Old Time Fiddlers Convention in Hillsdale. There are about 25, 26 different festivals that we've attended. So there are many.
And the idea is, as you say, video. So unlike the very, very famous Lomax field recordings of the 20th century, you've got new technology to work with.
Well, you know, I knew Alan Lomax in my early days as an ethnomusicologist when he was still alive. He did some wonderful work here in Michigan, but he's not alone. An English professor in the engineering college years ago, a fellow by the name of Ivan Walton, collected a lot of music from stevedores, from loggers, from miners. And a lot of that music is in the Bentley, along with all of Ivan's handwritten notes. And I've looked at some of that. It's exhaustive. Mm. And then there's Laurie Summers, who operates out of the Michigan State Museum. She's done a lot of work on the Lomax collection. But you're absolutely right. What Lomax did was a lot of audio recording. We're following up on some of Lomax's work. I mean, just to show the time depth and how things have changed since the 1930s and the early part of this century.
It strikes me that I was listening to some clips as you talked to people at these different festivals. And it seemed no matter what group you're talking to, you could be at the Irish Festival in Muskegon, you could be at a German festival, but people have that same – they express the same feelings when they hear their music.
When they hear their music and they appreciate someone from the University of Michigan coming to record and explore the things that they enjoy. And that's been an expression that we've heard all over the state. Mm-hmm. Boy, we're really happy for you to be here. We really want to see ourselves on PBS. We really want to hear ourselves perform. And I must tell you – the level of performance that I've heard from some of these musicians is just astounding. I spent many years of my life as an orchestral trumpet player, playing with some of the top orchestras in the country. And I must say that the skill and musicianship that I have experienced around this state is just astounding.
Well, interestingly, you're going to give future generations a really wonderful snapshot of the way things are right now in the early part of the 21st century so they can measure down the road.
You'd be a great ethnomusicologist because that's one of the things that we often study, and that is how music changes, all right? And we have to have certain points along a timeline to make those kinds of comparisons to, through analysis, figure out how that music has changed. I mean, I've done this with the work I've done in Africa. I've even done some of it with the work I've done in China.
Interesting, interesting. And so what's coming next? You're pulling this together. You still have another summer to hit festivals.
Yes. We're going to spend the winter months interviewing people. I want to speak with Fran Bluen, who is on our history department faculty. I mean, he's a historian of Michigan. I want to, you know, talk to him about how these various groups, immigrant groups, folk groups came into the state. I want to have some sit-down time with some of these musicians. I see them performing at these festivals. And in that context, it's very difficult to have a sit-down interview. So I want to invite them down to the campus, possibly for a lecture series, and to get the intimate details about how they were trained, what kinds of performance opportunities they've had, how they pass on these traditions to the next generation, so on and so forth.
Interesting. And eventually, I'm hoping, because I love folk music, I love ethnic music, that there'll be a big, juicy website for the rest of us to be able to plunge into and listen and explore what you've done.
We have a website that is about to launch. And it has a number of examples of the music that we've collected. Right now, we have a YouTube channel, and we have a number of pieces that we've collected over the past two summers just to give people some idea of the work that we've been doing.
So if they search for Michigan Musical Heritage Project on YouTube, up it will come.
They will find it.
Exciting, exciting work from University of Michigan musical professor Lester Mons and his team, the Michigan Musical Heritage Project. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Charter schools, publicly funded, privately run. Backers hail them as the way to keep public schools and public teachers on their toes because of competition. Here in Michigan, we have roughly 145,000 students in more than 300 charter schools, according to the Education Trust Midwest. And a report they released earlier this year showed charter school enrollment in the 2014-15 school year consisted of disproportionately minority and low-income students. Here's a for instance. 52% of charter school students were African American, compared with just 14% in traditional public schools. Andre Perry has watched the charter school industry take root, especially in urban areas, where the number of charter schools is growing at a much faster rate than suburbs or rural areas. He's seen it up close as the former founding dean of urban education at Davenport University in Grand Rapids, and as the CEO of the Capital One University of New Orleans Charter Network. He believes it's time for activists like the ones in the Black Lives Matter movement to pay much more attention to charter schools. Andre Perry, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Education reformers say charter schools and the choice they represent, Andre, are the ways to force failing public schools to shape up. And certainly we've seen that in Detroit. So what do you make of what has played out with the rise of charter schools in urban areas like Detroit that have large low-income and minority populations?
Well, I say all the time that urban districts are treated like black and brown people. They're over-policed. They're broken up. They are experimented on. And I don't necessarily think that there's anything inherently wrong with charter schools. But over time, you've seen that many of the devices that are used to fix districts are similar to those that are used to, quote unquote, fix black people. And so I think there's been a disproportionate amount of effort to apply charter schools to black communities instead of allowing black communities to reform themselves.
How do you believe the reformers and the state legislators regard black communities and black urban districts?
I think it's clear that they're more willing to take on districts in ways that they would never do in suburban or rural districts. The data is pretty clear on this. The disproportionate amount of our charter schools are enrolled by black students, and that's by design, because initially it was to, quote unquote, help poor, low income and black children. Now, if you are really into education, then you're into providing a better educational product for anyone. But you just don't see this type of effort being applied on white communities. And it's really because that black folk don't have the same type of value as white folk. And so endeavors to help people, we're doing anything under the sun in order to, quote unquote, improve their lives. And so you see all the time that we can break up districts, we can fire teachers, we can suspend and expel students in the name of helping, just as the same way we've said we can improve or clean up crime on the streets while incarcerating black and brown people. These are not trade-offs that we should accept. But you see it over and over again in districts, urban districts, particularly ones that are already ravaged by a tragedy. I had the experience to work in both Louisiana and Michigan, where you have New Orleans and Detroit, both African-American cities, historic African-American cities with historic power bases. And I can tell you that the reason why you don't see as much pushback as you would is because the decentralization efforts that have occurred in both Detroit and New Orleans hindered black voice to speak on what is good for them. Again, many of the machinations that you see in districts aren't inherently bad. There's nothing necessarily wrong with a charter school. It's just a small governance change that actually, and if applied properly, can actually get schools closer to communities. But the way it's applied, it literally upends black power. There's a nefarious thread in the movement that specifically wants to break up districts.
And so the effect you see on black communities and neighborhoods is what?
Oh, I mean, whether it's New Orleans, Newark, Detroit, D.C., when we wanted to improve the teacher workforce and we removed collective bargaining, guess what? Black women were the primarily ones that felt the burden of those changes and were disproportionately let go in the process. You saw, and this is changing over time, but you saw special needs services not being applied in ways that to protect all children. Suspension and expulsion on the rise. And all of these things were done in efforts to help the community. But at the same time, it eroded a Black power base. And I can't say this enough. Black people don't necessarily need choice. They need power. The reason why Black community schools are not doing well is because Black communities are not doing well. So when you break up districts, when you disrupt school boards, you are eroding Black power. There has to be a way for us to build capacity of Black communities while improving schools.
But, so let me ask you about that, because you know that there are people saying, look, you know, fill in the blank. We'll talk about Detroit, who say Detroit's public schools have been failing. Student scores have been abysmal. Buildings are falling apart. The system is hemorrhaging money. It's unsustainable. So what do you believe that needs to be the answer? What should we do about these, about really terrible schools?
But I think we put way too much weight on just education and not address all of these other sectors that are really eroding Black communities. I can't say this enough. The reason why Black children and Black schools are not doing well is because criminal justice is failing, because health care is failing, because public safety is failing, because of a whole slew of issues in the Black community. The reason why the Black Lives Matter movement is so important is because it can link all these factors together. So you can see the constellation of institutionalized racism that are impacting students' lives. Because this is what's happening all across the country. Yes, test scores are going up. Incarceration is too. Test scores are going up. Employment is not improving for Black communities. If you are authentically improving schools, then you should see changes in the workforce. We should be hiring Black and brown teachers. Those students should go on to college and come back to school. We've been in this for 20-something years now. And this idea that we're going to myopically and instrumentally improve schools to improve children's lives is just ridiculous. It is about having institutions improve the capacity of communities. And if we're not going to do that, then it's not worth doing.
What would that look like, Andre? What do you think that would look like?
I mean, I can't say this enough. We need place-based scholarships where people who live in the hood can go to public universities. We need incubation sites where folks can learn how to run their own charter schools. We need to train people on how to run for public office. We need to actually stop suspending and expelling Black children, because that's where the broken teacher pipeline starts, because kids leave school not liking school. There are so many basic things that we should be doing instead of providing millions of dollars to white-led organizations to help Black people that does not address the power issue that Black communities are suffering from. It is, I mean, this constant idea that Black people are broken and they need to be fixed. No, Black people don't have power. They don't have the capacity to uplift themselves. We have smart people. They're no different than anyone else in the community. They need training. They need incubation. They need support. Give it to them.
Andre Perry's piece on why the Black Lives Matter movement has to take on charter schools can be found at theroot.com. Andre Perry joined us via Skype. It was great talking with you, Andre. We want to thank you so much for taking time to be on Stateside.
Hey, anytime.
Coming up, Some recovering addicts turn away from AA and NA to find sobriety.
I don't mean to offend anyone that gets success from NA, but the meetings that I went to were filled with negativity.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When it comes to finding a pathway to helping an addict to recovery, most people and most courts think of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. The popular view is AA and NA are about the only ways to get clean and sober and stay clean and sober. But there are other options, options like Smart Recovery, Life Ring, Buddhist Recovery. And for some people, these alternatives can do what AA and NA cannot. With us now, Chris Odrosky, who works at Home of New Vision, an addiction recovery service, and he is a recovering alcoholic. Chris, so good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Caitlin Darfler is here with us. She is recovering from heroin addiction. Caitlin, thanks for being here.
Yeah. Hi.
Chris, so you work at an addiction recovery agency, and you are in recovery 8 years sober?
I will have 8 years in October, correct.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Was it about AA, about Alcoholics Anonymous, that didn't work for you?
Every time I was introduced to 12-step meetings, and usually it was a nudge from the judge, as they say, it was because I had done something to where I was required to go. That's one barrier right there, is that I'm forced to go. And then initially it was the higher power issue.
You mean God? You're working
the God thing? Yeah, also known as the God thing.
The God thing. Okay.
And I had been agnostic and atheist most of my life, and that I struggled with that aspect of it immediately. And also the powerlessness word itself, I struggled with.
Talk about that powerlessness word.
Well, when you come into a 12-step community, 12-step meetings, you're told that you're powerless over alcohol or whatever substance that you do. And sometimes that can get misinterpreted through the individuals in the program. The program itself says that we were powerless, and it says were instead of are. So over time, it took me a while to kind of focus on that. But then sometimes the individuals within the community, in my opinion, kind of take it too far. Like, you're powerless over everything. You're a powerless person.
So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm powerless.
Right.
So what can I do?
What can I do? I'm powerless.
Exactly. Okay.
And that ties into the higher power thing, because for someone like myself that I believe to be a little more action-oriented, I enjoyed the action steps of the 12 steps. I did not enjoy the spiritual aspect of the program or the religious aspect of the program. So when you were saying things like, I'm powerless, I must give it to God. And sometimes for someone like me, it didn't work well.
That's setting up a friction that you don't need as you are working to your recovery.
Correct.
Caitlin, you're recovering from heroin addiction and clean more than how many days?
I think it's 122 today.
Oh, well, congratulations on that. What didn't work for you with Narcotics Anonymous meetings?
Oh, my gosh. Very similar story to Chris. I mean, the whole thing started with me being like an atheist and not really jiving with the whole higher power thing, because they tell you it can be anything when you go there. But to me, it really felt like a bait and switch. Like, the longer you're there, the more they expect you to like come to God and have like some sort of spiritual awakening. And they do talk about the spiritual awakening aspect of it. And for me, like, I tried so hard. I tried rewriting the steps in a way that made sense to me, or I could apply to my life somehow. But even like the language, you were powerless, I still to this day disagree with that, because I was the one that got myself sober. I was the one that took action while I was using to get into rehab. You know, no one forced me. I never had any record or problems with the court. So to me, again, it's like that action-oriented thing. I took the steps I needed. I understand where it comes from because, when you're physically dependent on something, you can't really just stop without there being consequences. It's like having a gun to your head. You still have a choice.
Hmm. As you have been through this process of seeking recovery, and it's a struggle, isn't it? Because you've been through, what, about 8 inpatient treatment programs? Tell us about that.
In about 2 years. So I started using in about 2013, like daily IV heroin use. And for about a year, there weren't really any consequences per se, other than, you know, being dope sick occasionally if I couldn't get drugs. But after that year, I realized like I needed to do something. It wasn't cool anymore. I didn't have that like junkie pride they talk about. I didn't feel like I could continue this lifestyle. I was either going to die or just be useless for the rest of my life. And
So I went to my first inpatient rehab, stayed there the whole time, and I did really well for about 90 days. I was trying the whole NA thing and kind of experimenting with it, getting into it. And so much of it I saw, and I'm definitely biased, and I'll say that straight off. I don't mean to offend anyone that gets success from NA, but the meetings that I went to were filled with negativity. And I've been to meetings all over Metro Detroit, and there were certainly good meetings too, but so much of it was like, how bad my day was, how bad my life is going, telling the same stories over and over again.
War stories.
War stories, yeah, that's what they call it. And don't get me wrong, there are certainly people there that talk about useful things.
So it wasn't clicking. You go through this in and out of treatment programs. Mm-hmm. At what point and how did you hear about something that was an alternative, something different? What was that like?
I'm so angry it took so long. I didn't even hear it from anybody in any of the rehabs I was in. My friend, I found out a friend from a long time ago had gotten a DUI, and she was, I guess, required through the courts to attend some sort of program. And she was in Kalamazoo, I believe, and they allowed her to do smart recovery online since there were no smart recovery meetings out there. And she explained to me, you know, it's science-based. And so I was like, oh, really? Let me check this out. And I was just like, wow, these people are actually here and working on things they can do to stay sober as opposed to just talking.
Chris, as you work with people who are struggling, recovering, and staying there, do you find often that people don't know that there are other options? Because I could just see how angry Caitlin's face was when she's like, I just had to wait so long. Is that a story you hear a lot?
Yes. I work with clients at Home of New Vision, and when I get around to telling them, usually it's one of the first things I say. That's part of my job, is to get them informed as quickly as possible once they become a client at Home of New Vision. I'm not a clinician. I try to stay away from that as much as possible. I like being a peer. I like being able to do different things. I like being able to research these pathways, which is what they've allowed me to do over the last couple years. Most people have no idea that there's any other options out there. Or if they have heard, they're getting poor information.
As in?
As in, they believe smart recovery is a moderation program. They sometimes even think that's what the M stands for, because they hear the word management, they think it might have something to do with moderation. And that's not the case. It's an abstinent-based program. All the programs that Home of New Vision promote, all the meetings that we encourage our clients to go to, are all abstinence-based. They might not all be faith-based or spiritual-based, but that's not the point. The point is clients go to treatment to find abstinence, an abstinence lifestyle, recovery. And through these multiple pathways, which includes the 12 steps, I want to say that too. Yeah. You can't have a multiple pathways program without the 12 steps. Just because it didn't work for Caitlin and I, we figured out a way for it to work for both of us. I heard Caitlin said this very similar thing to what I did. I focused heavily on the action steps and kind of left the spiritual stuff aside. Because they say, take what you need and leave the rest. And I took that quite literally. And we leave that option up for our clients, too. While they're in treatment, they learn about these multiple pathways. And when they leave treatment, it's up to them to decide what pathway works best for them or any combination thereof. Because people are only going to be in treatment for so long.
Then they have to live their lives.
Then they have to go out into the world and be people like everybody else. And it's up to them to figure out what pathway works best for them.
I'm speaking with Chris Odrosky, who works at Home of New Vision, an addiction recovery agency. He is in recovery, 8 years sober, having dealt with alcoholism, and also talking with Caitlin Darfler, who is recovering from heroin addiction, over 100 days clean right now. For both of them, the traditional pathways of AA and NA, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, didn't work. And Caitlin, smart recovery did work for you. What was it and how does it work?
I make meetings when I can. We have a lot in Detroit, luckily.
And how do they differ? What's the meeting? What is it about that meeting that's working for you in a way that the NA meeting didn't?
If I could be funny for a second, we have acronyms and not isms. I like that. No, I just there's actually tools we use. It's kind of set up like a class with a facilitator like Chris. We go over things that will actually help us.
Give me an idea of a tool that you've learned through this that you can say, yep, that has really helped me to be where I am right now, which is saying that over 100 days now since I've used.
Well, my favorite is probably the cost-benefit analysis, which is essentially a glorified pros and cons list. But we make a sometimes we do it in class, like on a chalkboard or whatever. Well, not a chalkboard. Gosh, I'm so old. On a whiteboard. I mean, you can do it for anything, but the first one you usually do is about, like, your drug of choice and, like, the pros of using. You write that, like, on the left-hand column, and then the cons of using. And then on the bottom, the pros of stopping using, and then the cons of stopping using. And you go through, and if you do that on your own and you're really honest and open, writing it out is such a different experience. It was, like, a revelation for me. I'm just like, oh, and the best part is after you write out all those things, you go through and you mark which ones are short-term effects and which ones are long-term effects. It shows the balance. When you see it, that's just... Short term, it's fleeting.
That short term, that the long term benefits are it's the work you need to do.
Yeah,
they're great. They're great to do at a meeting too.
For sure.
Once people kind of come out of their shell, it's odd sometimes when you tell a group of people, let's talk about the pros of using and drinking. And
people don't want to address it.
But when I say, don't worry, I will not let you leave just talking about that. The surprise at the end or the aha moment is okay. Now look at these and see what are. Short-term benefits and what are long-term benefits.
And what's that slogan you were saying, change?
Change your thinking, change your behavior.
There you go.
When we get urges or cravings, we use kind of the thought as if we're being attacked by these urges or cravings. So the best thing to do is disarm the enemy. So one way of disarming the enemy is making it silly or giving it a voice, giving it something to personify the addictive voice. Which is addictive voice is something that's used in a lot of non-12-step.
Yeah, rational recovery.
Rational recovery uses it as well. So the addictive voice is basically the voice that you hear in your head saying, hey, let's go have a drink or let's go use. Mm-hmm. To disarm that voice one way, and again, it sounds silly, but it works, is to give it a funny voice.
Yeah. Mine's Veruca Salt from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. She's like, I want drugs now! You know,
and you can laugh at it.
Exactly.
It takes the power away.
Yeah, it's not me. My thoughts are not me.
Gilbert Godfrey is another popular
one.
That's
a good one. So how does Gilbert Godfrey talk?
Nothing.
No, but I know what you're saying. Make it ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And as you just said, that's not me. So Caitlin's not saying that is what you're saying. Caitlin can make that go away.
Just chemicals in your brain essentially telling you because you learn these habits. You learn that the drugs give you pleasure. So your brain tells you you need more of it, just like anything, like food or water. And
Chris, what else do you hear from the people that you're working with who say, you know what? This is working for me, and whatever the program may be, in a way that AA or NA doesn't.
People, first off, seem to appreciate just having the choice. Sure. Whether it works for them this time around or not, they really do appreciate the fact that there is a group of people, there is an agency, there's organizations out there that are trying to promote. And we're going up against, you know, we're not going up against that, but as far as marketing goes, you know, the 12-step groups have been around for 80 years.
Which is probably why no one thinks of these newer alternatives.
When SMART's been around for over 20, LifeRing's been around for 10 or so years, and Refuge Recovery was the Buddhist meeting that you mentioned. They've been around for, I think, 10 plus years, if that. But I know SMART because I took the training. Yeah. I know for a fact that they've been around for 20 years. So it's hard to compete with that level of marketing. You just, everyone knows about 12 Steps. 12 Steps are in Hollywood TV shows and movies. I've never seen any other type of recovery other than a treatment center than 12 Steps in any type of television show or movie. For a client to come up to us and say, just thank you for giving me these other options. When I can actually see someone engaging in these, they take what they need and they leave the rest from all the different meetings.
So there's no one size fits all. So it lets me tailor something to my personality, my addiction, my needs.
Yep. I still gain certain things from all the things that I've learned when I was in early recovery, which was primarily 12-step and outpatient treatment. I enjoyed my outpatient treatment sometimes more than my 12-step meetings, which I guess kind of led me on that pathway to a SMART recovery meeting because there's a lot of things that are in SMART recovery that are taken from the clinical world. When I had 3 or 4 years, I was really kind of burning out, I guess, on the 12 steps. And I enjoyed being in recovery, but I didn't know what else to do. I was kind of upset, like Caitlin, when I found out that there were other meetings. Yeah. I was also upset to find out that they were pretty far away.
There weren't too many.
And, you know, 10 years ago, the internet wasn't as available as it was now.
What do you think has to happen to make more people aware that there are other options? Not AA may work for you, NA may work for you, but if it's not, there are other options.
They need to get this stuff in treatment centers. I mean, honestly, because even my peer recovery coach, who I love to this day and still go to his meetings, he didn't even know what SMART recovery was. I'm like, how how are these people not getting this information? I mean, I literally had a counselor there tell me that if I did not get involved in NA or the 12 steps, I was doomed to fail and would probably die. That was a counselor. That was a someone with their college degree in this stuff.
So it sounds like
more training.
More training and more awareness in the field itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There are groups called Recovery Community Organizations, or RCOs. And there's a local group in Washtenaw County called Washtenaw Recovery Advocacy Project. And they have done a lot of work. I'm a member of that group as well. They've done a lot of work on advocating for recovery. Mm. And we've done events where we've tried to promote these multiple pathways. RCOs work independently of treatment agencies and any other agency. It's a nonprofit group of people that are in recovery from addiction and friends and family of those. Either they've had someone that they've lost or they've friends and family of people that are success stories. And they all get together and they plan walks and rallies. But a lot of times I look at it, and I'm not just saying that with the Washtenaw group, I'm saying it with all the groups. They're not directly tied to treatment centers, but they're connected because they're links. They can help people get to treatment. A lot of times I feel that we're preaching to the converted.
Yeah.
And I know I'm an atheist using that term, which might be kind of funny. But I do believe that a lot of times we are preaching to the converted, and we need to cast a wider net and get to the people that don't know. So, I mean, being on this show is obviously very helpful. Mm. I've had the opportunity to speak at opioid awareness groups. I've taught to social workers at hospitals. I would love an opportunity to talk to doctors and judges as well, because they're also ones that really need to know that there are these other pathways. I've had the opportunity to go to the local hospitals through connections with the social work teams there. And when they have people that are in the hospital for having something to do with substance use, I'm able to go in there and just talk to them and let them know that these other options are there. Treatment is great too, but like I said earlier, you eventually have to leave treatment. Even if it's outpatient, you eventually will get discharged. If you're doing good,
yes. Mm-hmm.
You will eventually get discharged, and you still need something, some sort of self-help.
Caitlin, where do you think you would be right now if you had not found Smart Recovery?
Probably in rehab again. I don't know. gosh, so much of what I've learned in Smart Recovery has helped me personally, because it's like cognitive behavioral therapy type stuff. So it's really working on yourself. But the thing this time that's really changed is last few times I was in Oakdale, I spent so much of that time, especially when we had to do 12-step stuff, like talking about Smart Recovery, telling the clients about it, telling my counselors about it, telling my peer recovery coach about it. Being able to actually like affect the system has been so satisfying. And I know that's like a tenet of the 12 steps actually, is like giving back and service work. And actually with another SMART facilitator, we've gone back to Oakdale and done some SMART presentations. It's so gratifying to me.
Do you think you could see yourself doing what we're seeing Chris do?
That's the goal.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
You guys share really compelling stories, Chris Odrosky and Caitlin Darfler. We want to thank you so much for sharing this and spreading the word and giving people listening the idea that there could be another pathway.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstrom. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Ryan Grimes. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.